I work as a psychotherapist, and I've been noticing that it seems to have its place to try to have a more or less stable self, more or less stable ego, to be able to transcend the ego.
Yeah, there was a book written a few years ago by Mark Epstein called You Have to Be Somebody Before You Can Be Nobody. And I bumped into him on the street in New York City a few years ago, quite a few years ago now. He said, yeah, I'm sorry I wrote that book. I would phrase it differently nowadays. So that was about 20 years after he'd written that book. So I think in some ways it's a question of phraseology, what you call a stable ego or a steady ego. So in Buddhist psychology, it's not spoken of in terms of having a healthy ego, but rather that if there is a life based on virtue, then there's a natural quality of self-respect, of contentment, freedom from remorse. And then that freedom from remorse gives rise to a quality of pamoja, or delight, or you can say self-respect, just to use that kind of language. You feel comfortable in your own skin. You're at ease with things. So in Western psychological terms, you might say that's a healthy ego. Buddhist psychology is like, well, no, it's just the result of not creating negative karma and to living a way that's unselfish and wholesome. That's the natural result of it. So some of it's terminology, I would say. But in a sense of Buddhist practice, those qualities of steadiness or of ease, of what we can call self-respect, they are established through generosity, unselfishness, virtue. They are kind of a natural result of that. If we continue to use the sort of Western languaging of things and talk about a healthy ego, then again, that's just as you were saying, you can end up what they call dramatizing the neurosis. And they're kind of feeding the sense of self, trying to get it right, get myself right. And again, unconsciously casting everything into the framework of, I am this person. I am a human being. This is I'm just being myself. I'm just being what I am. And that, even though the intention or the effort is to bring things into a state of integration, I was quoting Lumpo Sumedho saying earlier, you know, that I might develop all kinds of skills and live a life that's praiseworthy and good and beneficial to myself and others, but at the end of the day, I might feel quite disappointed. So that we can be unconsciously creating those limitations and those obstacles of self-view. And so that even if trying to work things out within ourselves or between ourselves and others, as long as there's that framework of I am this person, this is who and what I am, then even though there's the effort to try and be honest and realistic, then that can lead to limitation and disappointment. So recognizing self-view or saying, you know, and the languaging of things that you have in the Buddha's way is you start off from where you are. So you start off from the assumptions of self-view, like I am of the nature to age, I am of the nature to sicken, I am of the nature to die, all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise. That's where we start from. We start from the habits of ego and self-view. But then by, say, acknowledging those or looking at those, exploring those, then there's a recognition, oh, the body is not self, feelings are not self, perceptions are not self. So that we use those acknowledgements of self-centered habits and such like as a rung on the ladder, but it's not any kind of recognition or a pointing to an absolute assessment of who and what we are. It's kind of interesting. My understanding is Freud coined the word ego as a way of referring to the feeling of selfhood, the I am feeling, way back in the 19th century when he started writing. My limited memory of studying Freud way back when. So that, which in a way is like, yeah, there's the ego is the feeling of I am. Like in Buddhist language, we say ahankara, the made of I am, mamankara, made of mineness. So whether Freud intended the ego to be understood as some kind of absolute psychological structure that's fundamentally real, or just this is the I am feeling. That's what is, say, part of our world. So if we can recognize that I am feeling is a psychological structure, it has its value, you know, we can use our names, our identities. As Lumpu Cha would say, if we were all just called person, it would be very difficult to organize anything. It's like, who's on the washing up rota today? Person, 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 and person. Who's cooking today? Yeah. Who's we use our names and our identities if we use those in the context of understanding these are just convenient fictions, then it can be very helpful, very so beneficial. There's an essay, one of the articles written by Ajahn Tanisro is called "In Praise of Ego," so that you can find in his many and various writings. And my understanding is that if that it's sort of talking about that, you know, that we can use a sense of I as a conventional truth, and we shouldn't be afraid of that, or shouldn't sort of refuse to say the word I or me or mine, but understand it's just the conventions of language. The Buddha himself was challenged. Someone said, well, you say all Dhammas are not self, so why do you use all these pronouns? Like you say, you know, he, she, we, they, I. You know, what's with all the pronouns if all Dhammas are not self? And you can almost, well, not to second guess the Buddha, but you can almost sort of see him rolling his eyes. Like, but the Tathagata uses these words and these kinds of terms for convenience and for the means of communication. That's all, without any delusion about any permanent individual, eternal separate self. So as long as we recognize the uses of ego and I and me and mine as conventional truths, then it's rather than anything absolute, then there's no problem there. So when we take them to be absolute and something real and substantial, then difficulties arise.